on Pietro Ballori's text, in the translation, English translation of the lives of the modern painters, sculptors, and architects, originally written in Italian, first published in 1672. Ballori chose 12 artists that he felt best exemplified the modern artist. Now, we think of modern probably being more 19th century, even 20th century, but at the term was still used at back in that time, and it, of course, was a contemporary. The artists of his time or shortly before his time. He himself was trained as an artist, but discovered very early that he didn't really have much talent in it. And so he decided to become a man of letters and write about artists. The excerpt I gave you to read was on Nicolas Poussin, the French artist who spent most of his life in Italy. And so we will be primarily looking at his works. But we are also going to briefly look at a few other of these artists, the most important being, Nicolas Poussin, but also Peter Paul Rubens, who slightly precedes Poussin in date. Peter Paul Rubens is a Flemish artist, and his style of painting is very different from Poussin. It would be very interesting to contrast the two. These three names of these additional artists, Guido Reni, Andrei Sacchi, and Moratti, were not in the original publication. Ballori planned a kind of second part to his text, and he had already written those manuscripts, but they were not in the original publication. You can find, there's a recent English translation that does include them from his manuscripts, but these were not the main 12 that he chose. We will also look just at one work by Federico Barocci. He is really an artist more of the 16th century than of the 17th century, but he is what is considered a proto-Baroque artist, an artist whose style transitioned from mannerism to the Baroque. And certainly Rubens was aware of him, and so we'll look at one of his works. By the way, if you want to know anything about Barocci, I wrote my PhD dissertation on him, so I can tell you everything you want to know about him, just about. All right, but I'm not going to go on too much about him today. But he was considered by Ballori to be a very foundational artist for the 17th century. Other artists that we will mention are Caracci, Annibale, being the most famous. His brother, Agostino, is also included in the book. And Domenichino. Domenichino is really the link between Poussin and Ballori. Domenichino, an Italian artist who had a bottega, a studio, taught other artists. And that was whom Ballori trained with when he began considering his career as an artist. And it was also a studio that Nicolas Poussin kind of hung around when he was in Rome, and probably the location where the two met. Poussin was, in fact, a very good friend of Ballori and helped edit this text. So when you read about Poussin, realize that this is his kind of cleansed version of his life. And I'm going to give you kind of the other side occasionally about things. Certainly his triumphs when he returned to France are not always considered as such by other authors. Another artist that I understand you didn't really cover too much in this class, who's extremely important, is Caravaggio. Caravaggio is in many ways the, at least the way Ballori presents it, the antithesis to Poussin. You also had an excerpt to read on The Idea, which is actually a little section at the beginning of Ballori's book. And in it, he gives the idea of what it really takes to be a superlative artist, and that is one who does not copy directly from nature, everything from nature, but uses his own reason to choose that which is best. Caravaggio, though he's included in the text, was included grudgingly because Bellori had to include him because he was so famous, so many other artists admired him, he spawned all these schools of art, followers, even Rembrandt, which I do know you did look at. Rembrandt was inspired by Caravaggio. But Bellori really felt that he was an artist who failed in many ways by copying too closely to nature, as opposed to Poussin. Now, I have a question for you. Since the last time I came to lecture, you have some familiarity, I know, with some of these artists and other artists from this time period. Can you tell me what great 17th century sculptor is missing from this list? It's kind of the elephant in the room, shall we say. He even sculpted an elephant.
Bernini.
Bernini, yes, absolutely. The greatest sculptor of this century is nowhere in Bellori's list. Nowhere. Nada. Nothing. And that is because Bellori didn't like him at all. And so he would not put him in here. Very good. Whoops, that should have been over there. Okay, 1680 was his death. The sculptor that he did include in his list is François du Now, you have to help me with this, even though I speak French, but...
Well, it's Duquesnoy or Duquesnoy, depending on whether you pronounce it, yes.
Duquesnoy. Okay. he was actually a sculptor from the Belgian region who came down to France and was somewhat associated with Bernini. He actually helped work on the baldacchino, on the angels at the top. He also sculpted the St. Andrew. Is among the four saints in the center of St. Peter's, where Bernini sculpted the St. Lazarus, Longinus. So he was actually working with Bernini, and he never really was quite as well known as Bernini yet. Bellori puts him in here again, probably just to get Bernini's goat, right? Even though he really had died very shortly after this was published. All right, so now you kind of know the characters as we head in, and we're going to take a look briefly at Peter Paul Rubens. Now, Rubens comes from Flanders. He has kind of an interesting upbringing. He's born in 1577 to a couple who have Protestant leanings, and so they end up fleeing their home and going to Cologne in 1568 because we have a persecution of the Protestants by the Spanish Catholics who are controlling the Netherlands. His father ends up getting a job working for William of Orange. His father was essentially a lawyer. But his father gets in big trouble because he has an affair with his employer's wife, Anna of Saxony, and ends up even going to jail for a while. So they leave once again the area and go back to Cologne, where the father dies. Before the father's death, however, he made sure that Peter Paul had an excellent education. He had hoped his son would be a lawyer, an advocate like himself. And so Peter Paul Rubens was trained in reading and writing Latin, of course Flemish, French, German, somewhat, and Italian, because his father had worked briefly in Italy. So already at a young age, he had a knowledge of multiple languages and some works from classical antiquity that his father had him read. But upon his father's death, his mother took the family back to Antwerp, the main city in Flanders, where she reverted back to Catholicism. So Peter Paul Rubens was actually raised as a Catholic and remained so the rest of his life. He ends up going to Italy in 1600 because he is commissioned by the Gonzaga family of Mantua to come to their court as a painter. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with all his training up to this point, but he was already well known enough that the family commissioned him to come there. And he becomes really the court painter in Mantua. This is a painting slightly before he leaves. It's from 1599. Again, he leaves in 1600. So we can see what his work looked like before he went to Italy. This is the Judgment of Paris. Of course, the story here of Paris, who has to decide between the goddesses, which is the most beautiful. Of course, Venus receives the apple from his hand. Hera is not too pleased. And this is Minerva over here, who is giving us her backside. Now, this painting, of course, is really about the perfect woman. And the perfect view of the perfect woman, as we get to see the three women kind of from different viewpoints. We also have satyrs here in the background who are kind of lustily looking over at them, Mercury with his caduceus, and a river god and nymph, all witnessing the judgment. The colors are fairly subdued, kind of these dark blues and reds, and the paint strokes are very flat, and you can't see them. If you were looking at this at the National Gallery, the surface would be fairly smooth. This was the style of painting in Flanders at this time. When Rubens went to Italy, it really kind of opened his eyes to new ideas, and his painting somewhat changed. We'll look as things go along. Here are two works that he did for the Gonzaga family. We have the Marchesa Brigitta here on the right, and Maria, actually of Genoa, over here. But what these families would do would kind of loan out their court artists. And so these paintings are more about almost fabric than they are about anything else. Rubens was a master of satins and brocades. And if you are up close to these paintings, they will just shimmer and shine when you look at them. Of course, the Netherlands was a great place of importing fabrics from across the world. And so he was already, before he left for Italy, very familiar with painting these expensive types of fabrics. He is hired when he finally goes to Rome. He travels around Italy quite a bit, and he finally ends up in Rome, where he gets a commission at one of the most important churches at the time. It is known typically by the name Chiesa Nuova. It is a church that was built for Philip Neri, who was one of the reforming, he's not a priest, actually he was a he was actually secular for a long time and then became a priest, but he was helping to reform the Catholic Church and built what was called an oratory, where there was very exciting music and speeches that would help excite the people about the Catholic faith, and in many ways compete with the Protestant religions that were kind of drawing people in by their, not homilies, but their very powerful sermons. So this is an important church right in the center of Rome, and Rubens gets the commission for the high altar. So you can see already, this is 1608, just before he leaves Italy, that he really, by this time, has already reached a very high peak in Rome. Now, this painting is actually not a very exciting painting. This is the painting for the high altar, and it's a painting of a painting. There was a miraculous image of a Madonna that was an image that Philip Neri actually saw, where the Madonna came to life and warned him about a beam in the church that was going to fall. It was during the building process. And so he told everyone to go up, check the beam, and in fact it was rotted, and many people would have died if he had not had this vision. So what Rubens did was actually paint a painting of the painting, and this opens up in the paintings behind it. Interestingly, this is his second version. And I always like to show this because people don't realize that sometimes these artists would paint paintings, they were commissioned to paint, and people would reject them and say, no, I don't like it. Paint another one. I'm not going to pay you anything. And that's what happened. This is the second version of the painting for the Chiesa Nuova. This was his first version, which, personally, I kind of like better. But no accounting for taste. Here you have his painting of the miraculous image of the Madonna. And here we have St. Gregory before with the dove representing the Holy Spirit kind of having this image or looking up at the miraculous painting. Once again, though, this is very much a painting about luxurious fabric, and that's why it was rejected. They thought it was too much about conspicuous consumption and the saint, and really they wanted on their high altar a painting about the Virgin. So he was able to sell this off to someone else. All right. Rubens returned to Antwerp in 1608 because he got word that his mother was very seriously ill on her deathbed. So he left as quickly as he could. When he arrived in Antwerp, she had already died. Of course, you know, they didn't have telephones and cell phones and all those kind of things back then. So he didn't find this out until he arrived. And it was something, I guess because he and his mother were quite close and it was very difficult for him. But within a couple of years, he'd found a young bride and got married. This is a wedding portrait of him and his wife, and they look very happy, and he looks extremely satisfied with himself. Now, Rubens was not only a great painter and a man of letters that could read and speak multiple languages, he also worked as a diplomat. And while he was in Italy, he'd been sent to Spain for a short while to try to work on some diplomatic problems. So by the time he returns to Antwerp, he begins to establish his own studio and get many students to follow him. So he is very successful financially. I don't know exactly what your lecture was about Rembrandt, but I know that he really ended his life in poverty. Lost most of the money that he had gained. The complete opposite is true of Rubens. Rubens died fabulously wealthy. He never suffered for not having enough money. He had more commissions than he could possibly fill, had a huge studio, and I think you can get a little looking at his face that he's quite pleased with himself and with his wife. These type of marriage portraits were a tradition coming even from the Renaissance, where you get to see the couple of kind of in a symbolic garden, the garden of love and happiness, and you see them linked here with their hands. Now, one of his early paintings, very important commissions when he arrived back in Antwerp, was to paint a series of large triptychs for the cathedral in Antwerp, Our Lady of the Cathedral in Antwerp. This is probably one of his most famous paintings, The Raising of the Cross. I wanted you to see his works because they are really very different than what we will see with Poussin. And this work, I think, gives us some of the biggest differences that I will discuss. First of all, see how close the figures are to the front of the picture plane, almost as if they're crowded in. And as I take you back to look at this, you see the same thing. The figures are very pressed forward, and the space, though there is a horizon line in the background, really feels fairly shallow. And the same is really true here with the raising of the cross, although we have kind of this rocky outcrop here. We don't get a real deep sense of recession in the space. What we do, though, have is this incredible energy and dynamism. Part of this is created by the diagonal line. Diagonals within compositions always make our eye move. And then, similar to what Bernini did, we have really kind of spirals that torque around and, again, help keep our eye moving. And it almost creates a sense of movement in the picture, in the figures themselves, even though they're absolutely still, because this is a painting. So we actually get a sense of the struggle as Christ, of course, he's already been nailed to the cross, and the cross is lifted up, and you get this sense of real struggle as this figure pushes and another one pulls. And this, of course, is intended to be used as a focal piece for meditation on the Passion, as well as, of course, an altar piece that would sit above the altar where the Mass is celebrated, where the body of Christ is presented to the people and given to the people. So we have the body of Christ and the body of Christ. Remember that Rubens is working in a Catholic area of the country. He has commissions for the church. Most of these are by wealthy patrons that are paying for the works, but very different than Rembrandt, who does paint a Christian imagery, but not for churches. Now, this is a triptych, which is a really more traditional form of a presentation of an altarpiece. This shows it in situ in the cathedral, and these side panels can actually close. Nowadays, they have it all motorized. It's where they see if no one even comes over and pushes, but they open and close. And these can be open and closed depending on if it's ordinary days or feast days, depending on the day. So you get a sense of how these images actually function. This is another work for the same cathedral, and this is the Descent from the Cross, where Christ has already died. His body is being carefully taken down and handed to his mother. Where is his mother? There she is. And we have the Marys down here, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, and John the Evangelist are all helping. This episode in the Passion was one that was particularly important for meditation guidebooks that people can actually read while they're meditating on the Passion. Notice also that we have figures included in more contemporary clothing of the time of Rubens. This is actually advocated in many of these guidebooks because people were, it was suggested that they should try to think of these events occurring in their own town right before their eyes, maybe even imagine the faces of people they knew. And so he will often include a more contemporary looking figure in the scriptural scenes. Now, Rubens, of course, had seen and studied and drawn directly from Michelangelo. And I have an image from The Last Judgment on the Sistine Chapel wall behind the main altar. Just a little detail here to compare with Rubens' Last Judgment from 1617. Of course, Michelangelo was obsessed with nudes and bulging muscles. And now you get a sense of where Rubens may have got some of his inspiration for all these nudes and bulging muscles. What we have, though, in Rubens is, if possibly, even more activity and energy than you see in the fresco of the Last Supper by Michelangelo. Now, Rubens is working in oil, so the colors are a little more luminous. One of the fabulous things about oil is that light actually penetrates through the layers of color, hits the back panel or canvas, which is typically white, and then bounces back through. So there's a real luminosity. That is not to say that Michelangelo's paintings aren't bright and colorful, of course, now that they've been cleaned. I was there when they were like halfway through it and saw the difference. It's just amazing. But his colors, of course, are very bright too. Now that is something that when we look at Poussin, we'll see that he too is someone who is very familiar with how to use oils and color. What's interesting is most scholars consider Rubens a master at color and Poussin a master at design and line. And I'm going to argue here tonight that actually Poussin was a master of both. And there are scholars that agree with me, personally, I don't know. But here is a comparison between Rubens' Assumption of the Virgin from 1626 and an earlier work that he may have seen This is part I make this suggestion in my dissertation. Federico Barocci had two paintings in the Chiesa Nuova, the church where Rubens was working and painting that high altarpiece that was rejected, and he had to paint the second one, and then his mother was dying, so he had to leave. It's possible that he may have at one point gone to Urbino. Now, the date here, 1612, you would say, well, that's too late. He was already back in Flanders. But Barocci was an extremely slow painter, sometimes taking 7 to 9 years to paint a painting. This was found in his studio at his death, and there's no known commission. He may have even painted it for his own tomb, although that's not where it ended up. And it's quite possible that Rubens may have made a journey to Urbino and met this master, who had two great works in the Chiesa Nuova. So he was certainly familiar with him. This painting that ended up in the cathedral, the same cathedral where the raising of the cross and the deposition are, this painting is of the Assumption of the Virgin, the same subject. And this was a commission that Rubens had to compete for. He actually entered the competition shortly after his return to Antwerp, but it took this long, about 8 years, 10 years, before he even began to begin this painting. He won the competition. But he ended up painting a whole series of these Assumptions of the Virgin, possibly to kind of work out dealing with the grief of his mother's death and not arriving in time. All of them have this very intense swirling energy with the Virgin rising up and the apostles kind of reeling back. This one where they're looking forward, but he has other ones where they're reeling back just like this. I want you to attend to this kind of swirling energy. This is, again, something that we saw with Bernini's sculpture. Something that we would say is very Baroque about Rubens' work. All right. Rubens is also a master of the themes of from classical antiquity, as well as religious paintings. This is his Rape of the Daughters of Leucippus, and it comes from Greek mythology. Leucippus was the father of these two girls, Phoebe and Hilera, and they were abducted, we call raped, but possibly raped, abducted. That's kind of how men sometimes got wives in those days. They just kind of take them. So Castor, these two brothers, Castor and Polydeuces, took the two sisters, so it's called the rape. They abducted them and married them. But they already had some rival suitors. So the suitors went after them and killed Castor. It's a fairly elaborate story, but Polydeuces ends up being granted immortality by the god Zeus and persuades Zeus to give it to his brother Castor. We just have the moment of the abduction. Now, immediately you do get this sense, right, how close these figures are to the picture plane. It's almost as if she is rolling and undulating here, right before our eyes, maybe to teeter and fall into our lap. And I think you also get the idea of the Rubenesque bodies, right? Rubens did like his women to have a little flesh on them, which is a good thing, I think. And he also really enjoyed painting the nude. And when I say that, I can say that just from looking at his paintings. Now, many of his later works, certain parts of the paintings were done by his students. Certainly in this painting, most of it is by Rubens. And though you can't see it in the digital reproduction, if you were standing right before this painting, you would be able to see the translucent layers of skin. If you look at your own skin out in the light, right, each layer of skin, at least I'm very white, so you can see all my blue veins and everything through my skin, but you can see the various layers. Rubens could actually paint layers of skin, which I'm sorry you can't see in this reproduction. Something else he's very aware of is reflective color. Now, Rubens is an educated artist. He is reading the works of the ancients, such as Euclid's Optics, which discusses things like how light moves in straight lines and bounces off of objects depending on the angle. So if you see the little buttocks here of, I don't know if that's Phoebe or which one it is, you'll see how the red from this cloth is reflecting on her skin as well as that of her sister. You will also see the reflections of men were always traditionally, this goes even back to Egyptian times, men were always shown with darker skin because they were outside in the sun working. Women were very white and pure. And so you can see kind of the reflection of his skin off of hers and the light reflected up here. This is very complex painting. Something that a patron who was paying a considerable amount of money for this canvas would understand and would be required in their work. It is also something that other artists that know about this would see, and it's why Rubens has this incredible reputation. Now, the composition itself, in addition to being very close to the picture plane, is almost like this, in this sense, it's not a corkscrew whirl, but almost like a pinwheel that again just continues to move our eye around the painting. It is not still, it is not settled, it is not calm. And Rubens began to paint more and more with a very painterly stroke, to where when you come up close, you would actually see the brush strokes. He picked this up from probably looking at Titian in Italy. And here I have a detail, maybe you can see a little better, a kind of this reflective light. Now I'm showing you this because when we look at Poussin's work, we will see the same type of knowledge of how to use color and reflected light. And this is why I do argue that he was a colorist as well as someone who was interested in design. Just a few last works by Rubens to understand how he is very different than what we will see with Poussin. This is a lion hunt, which is primarily from his imagination. And I'm not sure how many lions he actually saw. But talk about violent, intense emotion and struggle, it's all here. He certainly did see some works down in Italy that may have given him some ideas for this. One of his most important patrons was Maria de Medici, who became the Queen of France when she married Henry IV. And after Henry IV's death in 1610, she commissioned a whole series of works about the great love between her and the King of France, which is really interesting. I don't know if you've studied them at all, but he had mistresses on the side. But they did produce six children, five of whom lived, the oldest becoming the king. But so it was really kind of a propaganda campaign. Because when Henry died, his son, the Dauphin, the king, the would-be king, was only 8.5 years old. So Maria de Medici became the regent. She was a Catholic queen, and so she hired a Catholic artist, the most renowned in Northern Europe, to paint this series for her. This is the beginning of the series, the landing, or not the beginning, I'm sorry, it's an important part of the series where Maria de Medici lands in Marseille. Here she is, the queen, a little thinner at this time, probably before she had her six children, and we have a personification of fame trumpeting her landing in France, where she is greeted by a personification of France herself. With the fleur-de-lis here, we have Poseidon and sea nymphs all watching as she disembarks out of the boat and arrives in France. It is a glorious day for France. Here are just two others from among the series. Here is the meeting between Maria and Henry IV at Lyon. They actually were married, betrothed here, and then married by proxy, where he was shown a picture of her and she was shown a picture of him. But then when they finally met, it's not even on the ground. It's up here in heaven in the semblance of Jupiter and Juno, or Zeus and Hera. And so it's divinely ordained. Complete propaganda. But they're beautiful paintings, and you've probably never seen them because they're way at the far end of the Louvre, and you have to get away from the Mona Lisa and go very far down, and there's a whole room with these in them. They are mostly by Rubens' hands because Maria de' Medici demanded it, although some of the background were certainly done by his studio. This is the final piece. It's called The Apotheosis of Henry IV and the Proclamation of the Regency of Maria de' Medici. Henry IV was actually assassinated by a Catholic fanatic. He became a Catholic before he became king, but it was someone who felt he was really a false Catholic. And it was the third assassination attempt. The first two were unsuccessful. But here he is being actually taken up to heaven, somewhat like a Roman emperor would. That's why it's called an apotheosis. All right, so Rubens is an artist who is working for essentially the most famous or the most powerful, some of the most powerful people in all of Europe. And by the way, their son that was the Dauphin is Louis XIII, who didn't really get to take over until he was 13, and even then he was under the control of his mother. Rubens' wife died, and he was devastated, but a couple years later he married a second wife. This is Helena Formont, and he was an older man by this time, at least, I think, 2 decades older than his wife, and this new marriage rejuvenated him. He used her as a model for many of his female figures. Here we have the Three Graces, which looks very much like the Judgment of Paris, in that we're really getting all the views of the perfect female body, according to Rubens. Every single one of these women are actually his wife. He used her to pose for them. And I want to point this out because we're going to look at some nudes by Rubens, by Poussin, and they're different than Rubens. He had a different ideal, a different aesthetic for female beauty. But he's still working in the same tradition. This is a painting Rubens did shortly a while after his marriage, and he became kind of fixated on love and erotic love after this second marriage. You see this young girl being escorted into the Garden of Love, where these women are discussing it, and this woman is already being kind of propositioned by this man. If you see, we have a statue of kind of a Venus figure with water coming out of her nipples, and this cave back here is supposed to symbolize intercourse. He was really enjoying himself. But Rubens did take something seriously. This is his painting entitled The Allegory of the Outbreak of War from 1638. It was made for Ferdinando II, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, and it was made really to celebrate the end of the 30-year war that went from 1618 to 1638 and really devastated Europe. This is an allegorical painting using figures from pagan mythology. We have a story that comes to us from classical antiquity that as long as the doors of the temple of Janus stay shut, there will be peace in the land. But when they come open, all, essentially hell, will break loose as war is upon the land. What has happened is Mars, the god Mars, has burst out of the temple. Of course, Mars is the god of war. You see his sword in his hand. Venus, the god of love, who, according to mythology, had an affair with Mars, is trying to hold him back with all her wiles. And Cupid, who's actually their son, is trying to also hold on and keep Mars back. But nothing will keep him back because he's being pulled on by this fury who is has with her famine and plague. What is happening as Mars bursts out is he is stepping upon literature and art. This figure is a personification of architecture and holds a compass in his hand. This woman holding the child is charity. And so what happens during war is all the arts are destroyed or damaged, neglected. We have finally here the ravaged figure of Europe, who also is calling for the cessation of war. So he was essentially a nonviolent advocate of nonviolence and very much against war. Again, look at how this painting is constructed, how the figures are right towards the picture plane, how there's all this furious activity. It's almost like your eye can't rest anywhere. It's hard to even sort out the figures from one another as they intertwine. You know, until I pointed out who was who, it's kind of hard to see what's going on. This is entirely different than what we will see with Poussin. This is the last painting I have for Rubens. He died, he certainly had a lot of fun before he died, but he died May 30, 1640 at the age of 63 of gout. So he probably was eating well at the time too. I particularly find this painting of himself and his second wife with their son funny because the son looks almost like a little monkey. They have him on a leash. But the same idea with this sense of movement in his paintings. All right. Now we are going to look at the works of Nicolas Poussin. There were some Italian words that the translator in your excerpt on Poussin used and did not really translate for you. So I thought I'd give you the meaning of these words. One was disegno, which essentially means design or concept. The reason the translator did not translate these words as design, you know, this word is design or concept, because it doesn't quite give you the entire meaning of the word in Italian. It's something that combines both of these. It's an intellectual idea of perfection that then the artist is able to put into their composition. And this is something that Poussin is considered the master of. Another word that's used, or two words, is historia and storie for plural. This in Italian means both history and a narrative. And often Valori will explain that Poussin is so able to give the precise historia or the narrative to a scene. And finally, a word often used for Poussin's work is affetti. This one is probably the most difficult to really translate. It can mean the effect or something that is affected. It is essentially the emotional response that you will see in the figures. That's often how Valori uses this. Before we jump into Poussin's pictures, though, I'd like to give you some background on Valori. Born in 1613, died in 1696. As I said, he was friends with Poussin. We think they met at Domenichino's studio. As I said, he began thinking he was going to be an artist, but changed his mind. Friends with Poussin. Now, the book he wrote on the modern painters, architects, and sculptors was really a book that was intended to continue the book of an earlier writer. And I hope you've all heard of Vasari, Giorgio Vasari, a Renaissance writer who wrote about the lives of Giotto, Cimabue, Michelangelo, and Raphael, to just name a few. He actually had four volumes of artists' lives. And so Valori was trying to do the same thing, but for his time, where Vasari wrote about the Renaissance, Valori was going to write about the modern time, which we now think of as the Baroque era. Now, Vasari had in his lives kind of his ultimate artist. And for Vasari, it was Michelangelo. Raphael was divine, but Michelangelo was beyond divine. Michelangelo was both a sculptor and a painter. He was everything that Vasari aspired to and everything he thought Vasari thought art should be. Valori also has the perfect artist, who is the hero, really, of his book, and it is Poussin. So we will see why Poussin becomes this perfect artist for Valori. One thing Bellori did believe was that after the death of Raphael in 1520, at a young age, that painting had begun to decay. In fact, the only really decent painters that came along shortly after, not that shortly, but after Raphael, were Arpino and Caravaggio. At least this is what was considered by most people. The mannerists, he thought, were terrible artists. But even Arpino and Caravaggio, Bellori criticized, as I said to you before, because they were guilty of looking directly at nature and not creating this idea of perfect beauty. Bellori gave a lecture about this concept of the idea and how real beauty comes from this idea. He gave it at the Academy of St. Luke. This is the Painting Academy. In Rome. He gave it in 1664. And what you read was actually from his lecture that he put as the preface to his book. Okay, what is the idea? It's based ultimately on Plato and the Platonic forms, but in a way it's expanded to Neoplatonic theories, particularly those of Marsilio Ficino, who was a leader of the Neoplatonic school in Florence that was patronized by the Medici. Neoplatonists were slightly different. You know, Plato really didn't like artists very much, right? He didn't even want them in his republic because he thought they kind of fooled people. And that you have the true form, say, of a couch. Then you have, say, maybe nature makes a rock that looks like a couch. And then you have an artist who kind of copies the rock. The person who makes the couch, and then you have an artist who paints it. So it's like third or fourth generation. Artists are kind of like almost magicians. They try to fool people. But the Neoplatonists believed that artists were actually a mediator between this perfect idea of forms and the world, which was imperfect. And Bellori ascribed to this idea. He believed that beauty existed in this kind of form, the way God created the world, but then the world was fallen, and so nature was not perfect. Therefore, what an artist needed to do was come up with the ideal in his mind, wouldn't have said her, his mind, and then look around at nature and find things in nature that were close to this ideal, put them all together, bring all the parts together, and make something that is perfect, more perfect than nature. Now, there is a basis for this in classical antiquity. There's a story passed on by Cicero about the Greek painter Zeuxis, who took an image from five different lovely virgins, whoever had the best arm, the best neck, you know, the best body, the best face, and created a painting of what Helen of Troy must have looked like, because there was no actual woman on the earth that could be that beautiful. This is Bellori's ideal. This is how artists should function. Again, not looking directly at nature, but not thinking completely out of fantasy either. They need to look at nature and then choose that which is best. All right. Nicolas Poussin was born in France in 1594. And like some people say about Texas, he got to Italy as quick as he could. I don't know about that, but anyway, he actually it took him three attempts to get to Italy. He wanted to go to Italy very badly. He too, like Rubens, was very well educated. In fact, his parents, although his mother was not really literate, his father was. And they wanted him probably to be an attorney. So he was, too, trained in Latin. And unfortunately for his parents, he loved to sketch and really decided fairly early that he wanted to be an artist. He began to study in France. But truly his aim was to get to Italy, because at this time the center of the art world was still in Rome. On his third attempt, he finally did make it to Rome in the spring of 1624, and how he got there was he met a man in France, in Paris, Giambattista Marino, who was the court poet to Maria de' Medici. He was Italian, she was Italian, that makes perfect sense. And they began a friendship. Marino was working on a giant, very large poem, which he wanted to publish. And he began to have Poussin draw pictures for it. The poem was based on Ovid's Metamorphoses and really used a lot of the pagan gods for the characters in his poem. And so Poussin had a natural affinity for drawing these characters from pagan mythology. So we have here an early work. This is not necessarily an illustration for the poem, but it gives us an idea of what his early works look like. This is just slightly dated to after he arrived in Rome. This is a self-portrait of Poussin. Here you have the story of Daphne and Apollo, who, because he bragged about being such a fabulous musician and hunter as well, ended up being shot with Cupid's arrow to fall in love with this young nymph, Daphne. She, on the other hand, was shot with an arrow to be repulsed by him, and he chased her and tried to abduct her, right? And she called out to her father, who was a river god, who transformed her into a laurel tree. We saw the same exact story in sculpture by Bernini. Here we have it in paint. What you see here as far as the style is kind of similar to what we saw with Rubens, where we have a fairly shallow space. Poussin is very attracted to the works of Titian, which he would have already known even in France. Some had arrived there, and also through Prince. And so his early works look very much like Titian's. However, very quickly, his style begins to change. By the way, Marino's poem was called Adone, and he did finally publish it. He took Poussin with him to Rome, and then he went down to Naples, where he proceeded to immediately die. So Poussin ended up being stuck in Rome without a patron and really suffered for quite a while. He didn't have much money. But he made small paintings, which he kind of sold off as best he could. This is a painting you can see here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area because it's at the Kimball Museum. It is Venus and Adonis. The goddess Venus has fallen in love with the beautiful hunter Adonis, who she knows will end up dying while on one of his hunts. So, and yes, this is the same Venus that was with Mars, and she has quite a few lovers. But here she's trying to convince Adonis not to go on the hunt and save him. Now, we still have figures that are fairly close to the picture plane. We have some strong diagonals. So in this sense, this work would really fall within this category of Baroque. But when we look at how the treatment of the paint, which you can't see that well here, you cannot see a single brush stroke. And the outlines of the figures are very strong. So even though we have the diagonals, the sense of movement is not quite as active as what you find with Peter Paul Rubens. What you do see, though, is some of this reflected light. And I don't know how well you can see it in this slide. But these shadows are not pure blacks or just darker shades. There's actually colors within them reflecting off. Maybe not as much as Rubens, but somewhat. So it shows us that already at this time, Poussin is aware of some of these more sophisticated theories about light and color. We do know that he, too, is trying to read as much as he can from, say, Euclid's Optics. He also, fairly early, is exposed to Leonardo's treatise on painting. He has an exemplar in Rome for these kind of pagan love trysts, being the foremost being in the Galleria Farnese, by Carracci. Annibale Carracci painted an entire ceiling in this room for a wedding, Farnese wedding, which showed all the different love relationships of the gods. Here we have Venus with, yet, someone else. My goodness, that woman does get around. This is Anchises, the father of Aeneas. Very good. And in fact, Aeneas is the son of this liaison. And by the way, whenever you see a leg over another leg, it means sex. They're having sex. Okay, but they're not showing us this. If you get over to the show at the Fort Worth Kimball right now, there is a show on love and art in Renaissance Italy, and they actually have a little room that has a warning sign on it. Don't bring little kids in, where they have essentially what is Renaissance pornography. And there's lots of these kind of images you can go in there and see. But we don't quite get the full Monty here, but we do get an idea of what's going on between these two figures. So certainly Poussin is aware of Carracci because this was considered, other than Michelangelo's ceiling, Sistine ceiling, one of the greatest artworks in Rome. At the turn of the century. And so Poussin begins to have more and more patrons that are looking for kind of these small, what are called cabinet pictures, sometimes about classical mythology, the themes, sometimes about literature. This particular painting, Rinaldo and Armida, which is, again, one of these small oil paintings, is based on a poem by an Italian poet, Tasso, and it's a poem about Jerusalem during the Crusades, where a love develops between a Christian warrior, Rinaldo, and a pagan sorcerer, Armida. Boy, is this good, juicy stuff. And so she's about to kill him because she doesn't like Christians very much, and he's so beautiful that she falls in love, and so she keeps him and holds him hostage in her enchanted garden. And so there's a whole series of paintings based on this poem, something that Poussin was very able to do. Notice that we still have only a few figures in his paintings. And of course, he's developing as an artist. Now, he's already about 30 years old by the time he is in Rome. He is also associated with the studio of Domenichino. And here's a work. Domenichino actually is more known for his religious paintings. This actually is a religious painting, believe it or not. It's from an apocryphal section of the Old Testament, Susanna and the Elders. I'm not going to elaborate on the story. But you can see some similarities in the few figures. And the interest, though, in perspective and architecture. And Poussin begins to have a great interest. He's in Rome, he's looking at the Roman ruins, and it begins to include them more and more in his paintings. This is a religious painting from the New Testament, The Lamentation of Christ, where we begin to see kind of this greater depth and this interest in classical antiquity in the ruins. Of course, this is actually the tomb of Christ. You have Mary Magdalene in mourning. You have the Virgin Mary and the body of Christ. Now, Bellori's theory about the idea was that the artist was supposed to take the most beautiful parts and create the most beautiful subjects. However, if the subject of the painting was something about a very sad scene or something of horror, those body parts, those figures, are not supposed to look beautiful. They're not supposed to give you this serenity. And so in this sense, when you look at the body of Christ, he looks truly dead. He looks like a corpse. There are some still odd things going on in this painting, though, and it's a fairly young Poussin. I think he improves as he goes along, such as when you look at these feet, you're kind of, where do they belong? Oh, well, they're the Virgin's feet. It's kind of odd. And so I think some of the criticism that that Bellori has against Caravaggio can actually be criticized. Poussin could be criticized in some of his earlier stages. Now here, speaking of Caravaggio, here he is. This is a work by Caravaggio that was originally in the Chiesa Nuova. Are you getting an idea? This is an important building. And Arpino had a painting in there too. This is an entombment of Christ, so it's a similar subject, right? After the lamentation, the deposition, the lamentation, then we have the entombment. And so Caravaggio is giving us these figures with chiaroscuro, these intense bright lights and a completely dark background. We get no sense of what's going on behind. Our perspective view is almost as if we are down here in the tomb. This is the tomb. And the cornerstone is jutting out at us. It's actually a reference to scripture of Christ as the cornerstone. And I did want to contrast these two because I want you to be aware when you read Bellori that you need to read him critically and not just accept everything he says. For example, he thought Caravaggio did not look at what was most beautiful. And in fact, I think the body of the dead Christ here is a beautiful body. Now, there may be a few odd things going on. Caravaggio always liked to play with people's minds. So when you look at these feet, sometimes you think, well, maybe they belong to her, or do they belong to him? And he did this intentionally to kind of confuse the viewer, to make you look again and again, to try to figure out his painting. His paintings are not simple. And just as the cornerstone juts out, so does the elbow of, this is probably Joseph of Arimathea. Now, I would even argue that this body of Christ is a more beautiful body than this body, and certainly those really weird feet. Okay, but again, this is early Poussin. But always read with a critical eye. You don't have to believe everything you read. Here's another comparison. And by the way, the coloration in slides, I try to get as close as I can, but it's not always easy. This is probably a little too saturated color, and this is probably a little too low-key, although Caravaggio did paint more monochromatically with his chiaroscuro. This is Caravaggio's painting of the Madonna of Loreto. This painting was commissioned for some nuns for a particular church, and it was actually rejected. It now is in another church. This painting by Poussin is the Virgin appearing to St. James. They're similar subjects in that we have an apparition of the Virgin. This actually comes from Spain when the Apostle James goes to Spain, and the Virgin appears with the Christ child on this pillar. And there's a lot of activity going on in this, by the way. Although, and very similar to Rubens, that the figures are all to the forefront. But each figure is much clearer, and the color is very, very clear. It's not painterly. Now, this is an apparition of the Virgin to two pilgrims who've made a very long trip to a place in Italy called the Holy House of the Virgin in Loreto, and I'm not going to give you a lot of details about it, but they were pilgrims that were poor and, of course, walked all the way there. Now, one of the things Bellori criticized about Caravaggio, again, was how he just took straight from nature and did not kind of filter it through reason and create beauty. When you look at the feet of the pilgrims, which I don't know how well you can see on this, they're dirty. There's dirt on their feet. And Caravaggio was often criticized for showing dirty feet, dirty fingernails, especially dirty feet on people like Madonna. But here we have a pilgrim with dirty feet. And I think I have a close-up of the feet here. If you compare Poussin's feet here, this is not James, but someone else who is here also experiencing this apparition, their feet are clean. And I think this is probably what Bellori was talking about, where this reality, which is the truth, that these pilgrims would have walked very far, they would have had dirty feet with calluses, he will show you this. Poussin will not. He kind of wants a sanitized version of this. Of course, this is actually from another pilgrimage church, the story from Spain. Okay. At this point, Poussin has been kind of scraping out a living with smaller paintings. But he finally gets in with the big wealthy family in Italy. He is introduced to Cardinal Francesco Barberini. Now, from my lecture before, Bernini, who was his main patron? Does anyone remember the bees? Urban VIII, the Barberini Pope, okay? A relative here. So he is really, he's not working for the Pope, but he's pretty close. And he paints us a couple of paintings. This one is really the most successful. It's the death of Germanicus. It comes from actually Roman antiquity. It's a story that comes from the lineage of the Caesars and the story of the early Caesars. You have the figure here of Germanicus, who's on his deathbed, and his family and his soldiers. He was a Roman leader who had great success in Germania against the Teutonic tribes. He was not Caesar himself, but he was from the family. He was the grandson of Livia, who is the wife of Augustus Caesar. His uncle became the Emperor Tiberius. So he's very closely associated with the imperial family. He himself had somewhat Republican leanings, and when you actually read history about ancient Rome, it's thought that actually Tiberius may have been the one who took him out. But the story that was told at the time was that he died in Syria. He ended up being sent to Syria and was poisoned by a local Syrian lord. So what we have going on in the painting is his deathbed scene. He's not quite dead yet. His wife is in tears. This is their son. And the soldiers are also very sorrowful at his death, but some of them are quite active. So we have his wife, who is Agrippina. His son, by the way, who is not shown really mourning that much, will become the future Emperor Caligula. Now, the contrast between the weak feminine side and the strong male side is very important. And if we look closer here, we see in the very center, the soldiers that were under him are actually taking an oath that they will revenge his death against this Syrian overlord. Now, the room in which this is taking back is a definite reference to classical antiquity, where we have Roman arches very tall. They go even beyond the top of the canvas. But Poussin wants us to focus on the figures and what's going on here and not so much the background. So he's created this kind of blue screen. It's really a cloth to help our eye focus in on the main subject, which is Germanicus. And of course, white draws our eye in the most. The lightest colors really show to us the clearest. So this is the focal point, which is contrasted against the blue background. And what is the main color scheme? Primary colors, absolutely. Red, yellow, and blue. And this really becomes the signature for Poussin. And he himself writes about color and how important these colors are. Interestingly, at the time, we call them the primary colors. They didn't know they were primary colors at this time. Leonardo thought there were six primary colors. Black, white, yellow, green, blue, and yellow. Wait, that's not right, because yellow is twice. Blue, red, green, and yellow, black, and white. All right. Now, he's using these colors to, again, move our eye across the canvas. But if you had the same image and it was just monochromatic, it would look very much like a Roman frieze, like something you would see maybe on a real Roman sarcophagus that existed in Rome. And what Poussin is doing is he's studying, again, the antiquity around him and trying to create a real sense of classicism. Are you beginning to understand why he is considered a classicist rather than a real Baroque artist? And this is his first great masterpiece. From here on, he really becomes the full Poussin. Now, this color's a little different, but you can see that these figures on the left are shown somewhat in sorrow, but notice how they're kind of hiding. This soldier has his back to us. These other soldiers are more active. And we have this central one who's taking the oath for revenge, where the women are more passive. By the way, this painting remained in the Barberini Palace until 1958. So you would think that not too many people saw it. In fact, the only way to see it was you had to write a letter to the family to go in and see it. But in fact, artists for centuries after this was done would actually go through the motion, petition the family, and get in to see this painting. And I understand in the fall, is it the modern world?
Right.
Well, I'm going to give you a little preview of one artist that absolutely worships Poussin, Jean-Jacques Louis David. Very much, he goes to Rome, he looks at Poussin, and this is where he gets his ideas that we now call neoclassicism. This is his famous painting, The Oath of the Horate, also coming from a classical Roman times. And I want to show you here, or point out to you, the weeping weak women and the strong men taking an oath. He also does another painting, The Death of Socrates, that is very much like the death of Germanicus. So this is a preview of the false message. All right. Now, Poussin gets another major patron. His name is Cassiano del Pozzo. And he actually pays for a painting to go into St. Peter's Basilica. Now, if Chiesa Nuova is a big, important commission, St. Peter's is the big enchilada, right? This is the highest level that you can get in Rome for a commission. And he paints this painting. It is the martyrdom of St. Erasmus, who was a bishop of Antioch, who was martyred during the persecution, either under Diocletian or the next emperor, Maximian, who wasn't emperor for very long before Constantine came in. He is sometimes known by a short name, Elmo. And if you've heard of St. Elmo's fire, this is the electrical effect that happens on ships during a storm. It comes from this saint, and his legend, his holography, is that while he was being persecuted by the Roman emperor, one of the things that happened to him was there was a lightning storm that struck and killed everyone around him except for him. And that's where he becomes the patron saint of sailors. Now, his death, his final death, was quite gruesome. He, if you saw Braveheart, it's the same thing. He has his intestines pulled out and wound around this windlass, which is actually the same device that's used to raise anchors, also a reference to sailors. Okay, what's going on in this painting? Let me go back here. We have a pagan priest who is talking to the saint and telling him that he needs to renounce Christ and accept Hercules. Here's a pagan god up there. And so you have these workers who really are, of course, the minions of the emperor who are actually carrying out the torture. And they cannot believe his stoicism. He is so brave. He's not even paying attention to the priest. He's kind of looking out, of course, at his final abode, which will be the heavenly realm. His mitre is down here, his bishop's hat and cloak. Up above, we have two putti, which are little baby angels, who have the laurel crown for victory and the palm for martyrdom. And they're just waiting for him to die, and he'll receive this as he enters into heaven. And even you have a horse in the background. Looking on. Still, the figures are very crowded to the foreground. There are diagonals. And so, truly, Poussin, though he is a classicist, is still of the Baroque era and is certainly, again, very familiar with Rubens. I didn't show you. I could go on and on with Rubens. Rubens has some martyrdom paintings similar to this. Here's your Putti. Here's your Hercules. And if you look at the faces of each of these characters, Poussin has really tried to show you something about their affecte, their reaction to what they're seeing. Do they have sympathy? Are they kind of hardened to it? This character almost seems to see the Putti. Possibly he is going to be converted to Christianity by the martyr death of the saint. And this soldier is kind of pointing towards the martyrdom down below. Here you have the concentration of the figure who's actually pulling the intestine out. And here you get the gory details. Now, though I say gory details, because we actually see the intestines coming out, there's really not as much blood as would happen in a real situation. Like, not that I've ever witnessed one, but there would most likely be a lot of blood. What Poussin has done is he's given us the idea of blood with kind of the red tones, the red here, the red here, and kind of reflected light here. He is not giving us absolute true nature. And this is what Valori's talking about. But he's giving us the best of what we can see to get this idea of this martyrdom. And this very heroic masculine body is reflected of the strength of the interior of his Christian faith. It's not necessarily saying that, you know, he had to be a strong man. It's showing us who he is spiritually. Here's just showing you how different colors in these slides can be. All right. Poussin, after this painting, let me go back and talk about this painting a little bit, because according to Valori, this painting was a great success. It was kind of the pinnacle of Poussin's career. He finally gets a painting in St. Peter's. But in fact, when you read contemporary accounts at the time, there was actually a fair amount of criticism of Poussin. He didn't quite live up to the level that the Italians thought a painter should be. And possibly because of this criticism, from then on, he no longer takes very large commissions from, say, ecclesial people or people associated with the church, and just works for private clients. He did become ill in 1629, around 1630, possibly in response to this criticism, and was nursed back to health by in the house of a French pastry cook. And he married the daughter of the cook. So he married in 1630 and seemed to have had a fairly successful marriage. Now, interesting to contrast that with this painting, which is of the Massacre of the Innocents. But these are the type of paintings that he continued to make, these small cabinet paintings. Of course, this coming from the New Testament, when Herod has all the babies killed. I'm looking at the time and thinking you might want a break. You want your break now? Raise your hand if you do. Okay. Can I just make it a 10-minute break? Is that too short? Nod if it's okay. It's too short. You want a 15-minute break. Okay. I have 6:21, so 31, 36. If we make it 8:40, that's almost 19 minutes. Is that sound good?
Sure.
Okay. 8:40. All right. Which leaves me an hour and 20 minutes. I'd like to finish early, but I'm not sure.
Oh, I don't know how to do it.